You know ID, ID in the D in the L O A. ID, ID in the D in the F E A. You know ID, ID in the D in the L O A. ID, ID in the D in the F E A.
Hello and welcome to episode number 202 of the Fabulous Pelton Cast. I'm your co-host, Kevin Pelton.
And I'm Tristan Carcino.
And we continue to socially distance from different locations. I'm in Boulevard Park, Washington, home of the Pelton Cast.
And I am in Renton, Washington, home of the Super Bowl 48 champion, Seattle Seahawks.
So.
And most importantly, Bruce!
Oh, we're previewing this. We're getting into it right away.
No. That's the home of Bruce. We'll talk about him later.
We do have some sports news to discuss because NFL free agency has continued apace, other than Jadeveon Clowney, but we'll get to that. Not a whole lot else going on is, you know, we continue to stay at home and try to avoid other people as much as possible, and hopefully all of you out there are doing the same.
Well, on that note, wanted to talk about the beers that we're drinking this week, because I've got a couple of them.
Yeah, and you keep telling me cryptically that you've got them for, quote, reasons.
For reasons, right? So first off, I have, from our good friends at Silver City Brewing Company, a Tropic Haze IPA, which I'm going to crack open right now.
Nice.
Because in this time, as so many people are losing their jobs, small businesses are closing down, at least temporarily, potentially long term, I think it's important to be supporting small independent businesses wherever and however we can.
Makes sense, yeah.
And then also, beer number two that I have here is Peroni Nastro Azzurro, because Forza Italia, we are going to get through this.
Okay, supporting Italy, that checks out. Now the third beer, I think that brings us to our next topic, actually.
Oh, you know there's a third beer. Two beers does not suffice for the Peltoncast. And as we induct the inaugural class of the Pelton Cast Hall of Fame, it was a shoe-in. It wasn't even close, to be honest.
Yeah,
it wasn't
you knew
fair
that was
for the other participants.
So we posted this poll on, I think it was Wednesday after the podcast last week, with your four choices in the non-sports category of nominees: Almost Live, the Blue Scholars, Rainier Beer, and Wild Waves. And, you know, lots of people said it was a tough choice, including Third Pelton Brothers C Styles, Chris Smith, our co-host on Talkin' Taco Time, who said, making me choose between Blue Scholars and Rainier Beer is very cruel. And then at the DJs, Dylan Jenkins replied, and like, y'all, I had good times and good memories as a kid at Wild Waves, asking whether this can be an annual thing, which, yes, we're definitely going to continue to do this. But I thought Chris said it well. My hand was forced, and that hand chose Rainier Beer.
I mean, you know, the logo of the Pelton Cast has no relation in the court of law. No, it's inspired by, and I mean, also, you're talking about Blue Scholars and Rainier, two of the most present parts of the Pelton Cast.
That is correct.
At least visually and audioly, orically,
audibly.
There we go. But Rainier Beer is the beer of the Pelton Cast, right? It as much as the Pelton Cast is about Seattle, Rainier Beer is about Seattle, and there was not going to be any other winner in this contest.
Yeah, understandably so. So it received 59.5% of the vote, 20.3% for the Blue Scholars, 17.6% for Almost Live, and a paltry 2.7% for Wild Waves, which perhaps is not as ubiquitous.
Wild Waves was the last one to be included. I wasn't sold necessarily that Wild Waves needed to be included, but it clearly, the memories that we have of going to Wild Waves as children are not as universal as, obviously, people's memories of something like Rainier Beer, or like, really, I think people might have been restricted by location. If you live in North Seattle, you're probably not driving a Federal Way to go to Wild Waves.
Reasonably so. But so stay tuned. Next week, we're going to do the sports category, The week after that, we'll do our second inductee for the non-sports category. So it's not going to automatically be the Blue Scholars because the fact that they finished second in this. We're going to give you a chance. Everyone who voted for Rainier can pick what they would choose out of the other three categories. But let's talk about Rainier a bit, because there's not really a time in my life where I can recall Rainier not being a thing I was aware of.
Aware of? Because there was a time when Rainier, I don't believe, was available in Washington State.
Is that
right?
True?
Yeah. Huh. Through our teenage years, Rainier Beer was gone.
Is that true?
I'm pretty sure that Rainier Beer was not available, and it started being repackaged in, I don't know, the late 90s, early 2000s, sometime around there. Once Miller Coors bought Rainier, it was gone. Are you seeing anything, any formal? Well, okay, so like, from our first memories, right? Like, we grew up in Boulevard Park, and in our parents' basement, which, shouts to our parents for having a very cool basement, there is an old school phone booth in there, like, I don't even know what era, 40s style phone booth. There's a pool table, there is wood paneling, and there are numerous Rainier posters and pieces of merchandise from Rainier Beer that we saw every day growing up.
Right.
Right? And it's like, there was a Rainier eye test that I think Jan took and actually framed, which I'll be putting up in my house, where it's like the eye test gets smaller. Do you remember what that eye test said?
Rainier is the very freshest beer.
Mountain freshest beer.
Mountain freshest. Okay. There we go.
Rainier is the mountain freshest beer, and the bottom line was drink one.
There you go.
On the eye test. I think the 2010 line was drink one. It was that. There was a Miller High Life mirror, and then there was definitely a can of Billy beer.
And
in our parents' basement.
And then a lot of Hydroplane posters that were either beer or cigarette related, because those are the only things that sponsored Hydroplanes at this point. I mean, the other aspect of this, though, is the Rainier commercials were so prominent on local TV.
Well, and I think the original Rainier commercials, this might be getting a little bit too inside baseball, but the Hadlocks, who Bear Creek Studios, which is where a lot of the indie rock records, which we'll be talking about in a few years ago, Joe Hadlock ended up actually producing most of those commercials during the 70s, who now owns that studio.
Yeah, and there's like a very distinct – the Rainier, and then also the anthropomorphic, I don't know how to pronounce that word.
Anthropomorphic.
Bottles running around in the wild.
Oh, my God. Similar to the clams, right?
Yeah. Oh, wow. The Ivers clams. I've forgotten about that element of it. But, yeah, I mean, that – again, it was just it's always been a part of our lives. The weird thing is I don't feel like when I started drinking beer that I drank Rainier at first.
We definitely drank a lot more Carlo Rossi right away. and drank it was like a progression. I remember drinking a lot of Miller High Life.
I remember drinking a lot of Pyramid, a lot of Hef.
Oh, we did drink a lot of Pyramid around that time. That was like our first foray into like quote unquote craft beer, was drinking Pyramid beer. But it was like at some point everybody around us kind of just came to the conclusion that we only want to drink Rainier, and we only want to drink Rainier in, if glass bottles are available, absolutely. But they're usually not, in Rainier Tallboy form. That is like, that is the way that you drink Rainier, in 16-ounce form, in an aluminum can.
Sadly, I don't have a Tallboy right now.
I don't either, because we gotta really stock up here for these end times. You gotta get your Rainier 24 at a time.
that makes sense, I guess.
But right, it was just like, we all agreed, like, we only wanted to drink light beer for the volume. Maybe you have like one nice beer and then a lot of light beer, and that beer is going to be Rainier beer. This is not a PBR town, right? This is a Rainier town. And that I think is the cool thing about it. And I've always had this passion for like the sort of like, I don't know the exact years, I'm going to call them 60s era, like local beers. You know, there's Lone Star in Texas, there's PBR in Milwaukee, there's Schlitz in Chicago, and there is Rainier beer in Seattle. Like, this is ours. It's in our blood, right?
And to a certain extent, Portland, I feel like, has adopted Rainier as its own as well.
They would. And that's why you made the right decision to move to Seattle and not Portland.
Also, is Schlitz in Chicago? Isn't it in Milwaukee as well?
You think Schlitz is in Milwaukee?
I'm pretty sure it's in Milwaukee as well. A few other things about Rainier, I think, that we should note that help explain its cultural significance.
Also in Milwaukee, you're right.
Yeah. Just a lot of beer in Milwaukee, and I guess Denver's all Coors, but those two in particular. The fact that there was the Tacoma Rainiers eventually in AAA, and then the Seattle Rainiers historically, like, those help cement the legacy of Rainier too.
I mean, it's crazy that how much this mountain is part of who we are as people. And we talked about it when we were talking in that conversation about moving to Portland or Seattle. And it's like the mountain is a weirdly large factor in our lives. And it's like that Rainier is not just about the beer, but it's about all of those things.
No, the Seattle Rainiers was specifically about the beer because it was, you know, the owner of Rainier who owned the
beer. He owned the Rainiers?
Yeah.
Sorry, I don't want to assume anything.
I think you can. Yeah, in 1938, Emil Sick was the owner of Rainier Brewing Company. Then the
stadium.
Seattle Indians. Yes, and then named the stadium after himself.
There we go.
Yeah.
Well, there's the other thing where it's like, we also, every time you drive into the city from the South End, you're driving past a giant red R.
Except for the brief period where you were driving past a giant green T when Tully's took
Bleak.
Over the radar.
Bleak.
And yeah, but that's the other thing I was going to mention. And it's also very fitting for the Pelton cast that the Rainier R came back in the fall of 2013.
Wow.
Coinciding with the first version of the Pelton cast.
I mean, that happened like, we were on episode like 3 or something when that happened.
It would have been like 7, I think.
And also, Tully's, you deserve to go out of business by doing that, if we're being honest.
I mean, it was...
Read the room, Tully's.
Was the R already down before Tully's put the T up?
No.
Oh, yeah, that was pretty bad.
They took the R down and put up a damn T for Tully's? Are you kidding me? So as children, beyond that, so our parents used to go, I think this was with the Lodge, right?
Yeah, the Sons of Italy Lodge.
With the Sons of Italy Lodge, again, Forza
Italia.
It was
precisely episode 7.
Wow, that is too much.
I mean, I'd seen what the date was, so I had a pretty good idea of when it was.
You knew it was week 8 of the NFL season. As children, with the Sons of Italy Lodge, they would rent out like a space at the Rainier Brewing Company. And this was when they actually brewed Rainier there. And they would do these things called beer busts, which, why are we not doing beer busts now?
Well, we can't.
And they would cook up.
You know what's funny, though? I watched the movie Dazed and Confused last night, and they refer to the party that they're having in the woods as a beer bust.
Really?
So that was immediately what I thought of.
Maybe we just need to reframe things as beer busts. We just need to start calling stuff beer busts.
We're both drinking beer. Are we having a beer bust at the moment?
I think we might be, because I have 3 beers in front of me. So, but they would go to these beer busts, and the Renaissance of Italy would cook up a shit ton of pasta, and they would just go and eat tons of pasta and drink a shit ton of beer, right? And I think our grandpa would typically drive. Right, back when he had a thick black mustache.
I don't know how the driving situation worked.
I'm pretty sure that he would drive and everybody else would come home wasted from these beer busts. Right? It's like, God, how amazing is that? That you would just go to a brewery and eat a ton of pasta made by old Italian people and drink Rainier beer? Like, is there a better situation in the world?
That sounds pretty great, I gotta be honest. I mean, first off, being able to go anywhere sounds pretty great.
Yeah, being able to leave the house would be really nice. Oh my god.
I'm on the Rainier Beer Wikipedia page. I did not realize that it was in the movie Stand By Me.
Oh, there we go.
Because that's set in Oregon.
That's important.
Also in Twilight, where they use the term vitamin R.
Wow.
which we have not mentioned here and is an important thing to remember, that you got to take your daily vitamin R.
There is vitamin R. Also, a couple weeks ago, I made a Rainier Rita, which is Rainier with a lime in it.
Nice.
I was talking to this. As a minor anecdote. I was talking with Sarah Tudson from Illuminati Hotties, who is an aficionado of cheap beer, right? And she was saying, I was like, to me, Lone Star is like that. I love Rainier because Rainier is always there for me. But Lone Star, I have basically for like a 4-day period every single year. You know what I mean? So it's like there's something kind of amazing about that, which is the way that you would feel if you came to Seattle only a few days a year, had Rainier just for a few days or whatever.
And you also connected it with like this exciting, you know, thing you were doing where you were hanging out with all your friends.
Yes.
And out of town, you know.
Yeah, and also it was ripped away from you this year. But like, so I'm always like drinking Lone Star for that week at South by Southwest. There's like no better experience than that. And honestly, I don't want to drink anything else. You know, like there have been various times where I was like, I'll try an Austin craft beer or whatever. And I'm like, fuck this. I want to drink 12 Lone Stars instead. And
I still regret not having a Lone Star the last time that I was in Texas.
You didn't have a single Lone Star?
No, we talked about this on the pod back then when I was in Fort Worth with...
Not when we went together.
No, when we went together, there were many Lone Stars consumed. I was thinking of that trip earlier because I was listening to the J.J. Redick podcast and they were talking about ranking their top cheap eats under $10 and Vera Cruz tacos came up.
Oh, wow, really? Cheap eats under $10 in Austin or anywhere in the world?
Anywhere in the country.
Wow, Vera Cruz was in there. Top 10?
In the top 5.
Man, that place has gotten so popular, though. It's feel like popular. I did not invent Veracruz tacos, but like I discovered it. It was one of those things where when you discover something without anybody telling you about it, right? Like that's the coolest thing there is. When you're just like – or like Loretta's. Like nobody told us about Loretta's. It was just like
– Well, someone must have told us about Loretta's. But it wasn't Eater maybe at one of the top 10 burgers in the country.
Yeah,
I should say.
I don't know how we first found out about Loretta's. Maybe because it was a freaking block away. But like,
that's Pelton Cast Hall of Famer Loretta's to you.
There we go. But like, it was definitely we're too far off the topic for Rainier. Anyway, so I was talking to Sarah.
Right, you believe me? A lot of Rainier has been consumed at Loretta's, good sir.
I was talking to Sarah about Lone Star or whatever, drinking at South by Southwest, and she was like, "To me, Rainier is the best beer in the entire world." Because I was also like, I'm on Tecate a little bit, and she was like, "You have the best beer in the entire world right there in Seattle." And I was like, "Hello, here we go."
Are we taking it for granted?
I mean, clearly we're not. I have 24 of them upstairs.
Fair point. Well said.
So it's not only is it part of our history of our DNA, it's also the best beer in the entire world.
There you go. So that's why it is our first voted pick for the Pelton Cast Hall of Fame coming up next week.
Wow.
We will move into this, or this week, I should say. But we'll be announced the winner next week. We'll move into the sports category, where, as a reminder from last week, our nominees are Ken Griffey Presents Major League Baseball,
okay,
Sean Kemp and Gary Payton,
uh-huh,
Jermaine Kearse, and Brandon Roy. And
man,
I look forward to seeing whether any of those other ones get a vote besides Kemp and Payton.
You think Kemp and Kearse versus Kemp and Payton?
I think Kemp and Payton are they're minus 300 to win this, I would say.
You think so?
Yeah. I mean, there's some Seahawks fans who are going to vote for Kearse because all they care about is the Seahawks. And there's some UW folks who might vote for Brandon Roy. But Kemp and Payton, I mean, the combination, the two of them. Like, Nate Duncan has been doing this thing on his various podcasts over the last couple of weeks where, you know, just kind of to remember why we love basketball in this period where we're not able to watch it live. You know, he's been asking people, who's your favorite all-time player to watch? And I'm like, I can't answer that because it's Kemp and Payton combined.
Yeah, that's why they could be going into the Pelton Cast Hall of Fame together.
They're going in. I think we can safely assume they're going to make it. But that voting will begin. I will probably post that poll on – well, I'll probably post it on Monday since Don't have to wait for the surprise of the Pelton Cast Hall of Fame and learning that's happening this time.
So Nate Duncan is not taking up rapping about how he can't go to NBA games.
He has not, yet done that.
Not yet, okay. Alert me immediately if he does.
He did muse on one of the podcasts about going to play basketball at the park where he and Danny LaRue were photographed famously for a story. Do you know these photos?
I think that I do. Was that the one where they talked about all of the different cap space, right? I remember reading that.
I don't remember that part of it, that article.
But Kevin Payton, we'll talk about them next week, most likely. I still think Curse has an outside chance. But it is true. Like, there's no separating Kemp from Payton. You don't love Sean Kemp and you don't love Gary Payton. You love them together. I mean, there's a few combos like this that persisted. I think Malone and Stockton are probably the same way in Utah, where you don't necessarily have feelings about one vis-a-vis the other. It's just like, you love them as a combination.
I mean, that's maybe even different because of the fact that their careers overlapped even more so than Kemp and Payton's, whereas there was the long period where Payton was a Sonic after Kemp was traded.
It was never the same.
No, but technically Payton's best years. By the way, I should have mentioned this off the top. The Pelton Cast Hall of Fame, of course, presented by our friends Pagliacci Pizza.
Because Pagliacci has Rainier Tall Boys. And so do we.
Actually, technically, at this point, we don't have Rainier Tall Boys.
So
we've already said that, but
we.
So our sponsor is Pagliacci. Kind enough last week. So a few weeks ago, when I was in Boston at the Sloan Conference and at the Celtics Jazz game before the NBA shut down, I posted on Instagram a photo of David Locke's Pagliacci water. Why can't I remember the term here?
Bottle.
Yes, that's what I was going for. So he has like a vintage.
You remember
90s
episode
style.
7 is when we talked about Rainier opening, but this eludes me.
He had a vintage 90s style Pagliacci water bottle that was awesome, and obviously I was extremely envious of this, but I posted on it, tagged them, and it got back to the corporate office, and thanks so much to the owner of Pagliacci, Matt Galvin, who
name dropping again.
Sent us both green and gold water bottles.
Wow. Hello.
The current Pagliacci logo and everything. So we will be sporting those for sure. And Pagliacci is part of the, current state of affairs. Remains open for limited contact takeout and no contact delivery. So an excellent option to support a local business, as you were mentioning, during these times where we are all at home.
I'm going to have to get up on that maybe tomorrow.
Yeah, you definitely should get up on that.
As soon as possible.
Especially because I was looking at the seasonal pizzas, and one of them was really speaking to me.
As far as a little bit of housekeeping for the Pelton Cast Hall of Fame, wanted to explain, you explained how we were going to do the voting, and somebody mentioned that they were making a difficult decision in the first round. So basically, the way that we're doing this is if you don't make the Hall of Fame the first year, you can be nominated again for the second year, right? So that would be next year. And we're going to assume that we're doing this around March, April every single year because we're not going to have to talk about Husky basketball going to the NCAA tournament. And so if you're nominated for a second year and then don't make it, you're not eligible to be nominated after that. So you have 2 years to be nominated as a fan vote Pelton Cast Hall of Famer. Then on the third year, you would become eligible for the Veterans Committee, which is you and me as veterans of the Pelton Cast. You would be eligible to be nominated as one of the four Veterans Committee nominees, but you don't have to be.
Well, I don't know that we're going to do four every year for
or
the Veterans Committee.
Or at least you could be a Veterans Committee nominee.
Yeah.
But there's only 2 years of fan voting that each individual thing is eligible for.
But hypothetically, all four that are currently on the ballot then could make it under those rules.
And Wild Waves is struggling.
Well, yeah, I'm saying hypothetically. I'm not guaranteeing it.
Wild Waves is like the Marquise Grissom or something.
It's like getting the one token vote.
It's like Tino Martinez.
The Poliachi seasonal I was looking at is the Matador Primo. From the toe of southern Italy, involving the regional specialty, a spicy spreadable sausage known as Nduja, along with Castelvetrano olives, green olives, creamy fresh mozzarella, and tangy manchego cheese. It looks quite amazing.
That sounds good. Are you going to get a pizza?
I'm not in delivery, so I'll have to see if I can do takeout at some point.
Yeah, I'm going to have to drive to fucking Bellevue. It's really quite terrible. Also, Poliachi, open up a location in Redden, please. The water bottle is nice, but open up a location in Redden.
Again, thanks so much for the water bottle. It's now time for us to turn our attention backwards. I guess we already were with radio. But as we remember another year, moving on this time to 2002. Did you have anything to say about 2002?
I have a lot of things to say about 2002. Okay. But I think I've got a take. But I want to hear about 2002 in sports first before I deliver the take.
Well, let's start by talking about the Sonics, because 2002 is an important year in Sonics franchise history, and that's because they hired me as an intern.
So this is when it all started to go down.
No, it went up.
They hired you as an intern, and 5 years later, the team would be moved.
Six. I don't think you draw a direct connection there. So the 2001-02 season was a kind of fun season, I think. The Sonics took the Spurs to 5 games in the first round. That was, you know, the first playoff series since 2000. You know, they'd been out of the playoffs for a year. I have fond memories of the 2001-02. I don't know, team. I don't know about you.
No recollection whatsoever.
I mean, that was the first team that, like, I was following, really following day in and day out because of the fact that I was writing for SonicCentral.com at that point.
Was Desmond Mason a rookie, or?
It was his second year. We mentioned last week that Vlade Radmanovic was drafted in 2001, along with Earl Watson was a rookie on that team, and Peja Drobniak, who was also acquired through the draft.
Wow, Drobniak's maniacs.
Jerome James arrived in Seattle.
So this was
started
sort of
in center much of the season.
Was this the year that they traded GP, or had they already traded GP?
Neither of those. GP was on that team, and then kind of got worked over by Tony Parker in that San Antonio series.
As a very, very young Tony Parker, right? He was like 19-year-old Tony Parker.
He was 19, yes.
So we haven't got – GP was traded in 2003?
He was traded in 2003.
Really?
Yeah.
It does not seem like it was that late. Okay. But we started seeing sort of the outline – of the 04-05 Sonics team that we both cared so much about.
So maybe, you know, again, aside from hiring me, the most important thing that happened in the Sonics in 2002 is they traded Vin Baker.
Yep.
Things had not been going well. Every year kept hoping that this is going to be the year that he gets back to the old Vin Baker, but his struggles with alcoholism were a major factor in preventing that from happening. And then the Celtics somewhat inexplicably traded Kenny Anderson, Vitaly Potapenko, and the immortal Joe Forte to the Sonics.
The immortal Joe Forte.
Or Vin Baker.
We loved Joe Forte in college, too.
Oh, I thought he was a star. I was very convinced. And so I was quite excited when he was in this trade, and then not so excited when he eventually played for the team.
Oh, my God. Who was I thinking of? I was thinking of Antonio Daniels the other day. Antonio Daniels is one of the most underrated players in NBA history.
That's probably true. I mean, I would nominate friend of the pod, Brent Baker.
Brent Baker.
Again, water bottle. The word is water bottle.
You actually were looking for the word bottle?
Well, previously I was. In 2002, that 2001-02 season, Brent Perry led the NBA in two-point percentage, effective field goal percentage, which he had also done in 2000, and possibly true shooting percentage as well, yes. Back when I was coining the term true shooting percentage.
Oh, my God. if if Bones would have played in 2019, not 2020, of course, because basketball doesn't exist anymore, he would be like a borderline star.
Yeah, I'm not sure who would be the Brent Berry-like player of today, like hyper-efficient in a fairly small role.
You don't think it's Jage?
He's not – J.J. Redick is not quite as hyper-efficient as Brent Berry is.
So Brent Berry is better than J.J. Redick?
I think probably a little bit better, yeah.
I mean, he was good.
Like, J.J. Redick shoots too many long twos. Brent Berry already was way ahead of his time in terms of only threes and dunks.
Short of three-point line at the time, too.
No. They had moved it back by that point.
Wait, really? They haven't moved it since?
Yeah.
Oh.
I mean, it moved out to back to its current distance, which was its original distance after the 97 season, I believe.
Wait, really? I thought they moved it again.
No. You're thinking of college basketball.
Well, whatever. So who is the starting lineup for that team? You have GP. You have Bones.
Yep. Rashard Lewis at the three.
Oh, wow. Rashard.
Vin at the four, although they went on a major run when Vin Baker was injured. And
then Potapenko?
No, Potapenko didn't get there until the following summer. Jerome James and Art Long started at center.
Art Long, who once punched a horse.
That is correct. Allegedly, actually.
Literally everything I know about Art Long is that potentially at Cincinnati he punched a horse. But so this was really, I mean, like, you remove some very big elements. But, like, by the time you get to 2005... the role players are in place, right? Like, these are going to be the role players who are going to be important factors to that 2005 team.
Yep. I mean, really the next year, I guess, with the Payton trade, but we will get to that.
But this at the same time was like, it was a mostly forgettable season. They didn't have a good draft pick. They were the 8 seed when they lost to the Spurs, or the 7 seed.
I think they were the 7 seed.
They were the 7th seed and lost to the Spurs. You said they pushed them to 5 games, which means they won a game.
Although partially because Tim Duncan missed game 4 to attend the funeral of one of his parents.
So they won a game that Tim Duncan didn't play.
They won 2 games to force it to 5. It was best of 5 still, though.
Oh, well, Jesus Christ. The 3-point line is long. The series are short. So they pushed them to a deciding game 5.
Oh, also, we should tell a story about the draft here. So the Sonics did not have a first-round pick that season. I forget where they had traded it exactly, but they did not have a first-round pick. They only drafted in the second round. And so I'm, like, sticking around through the draft through pick 50-something, and I desperately wanted the Sonics that year to draft Reggie Evans out of Iowa.
Oh, God, you loved Reggie Evans.
I did. I mean, he's such an amazing rebounder. And I was kind of excited because the pick they didn't actually show the Sonics pick, and then they showed Darius Singaila, who went with the next pick to Boston. I was excited about Darius Singaila too, but it turned out instead the Sonics had drafted a German big man named Peter Faza, who never even sniffed the NBA. But then they signed Reggie Evans as an undrafted free agent, and Reggie Evans was the very first person I ever interviewed in my life at Sonics Media Day that year.
Did Moneyball exist at this point, right? Had the book come out yet?
No, the book came out in the spring of 2003.
The concept existed, though, right? Had people been talking about, like...
statistical analysis?
Well, obviously statistical analysis, but, like, people who were really good at one particular thing, right? Where it was, like, Kevin Euclid was the Greek god of walks, and... Reggie Evans was kind of the Greek god of rebounds.
I don't know if I'd go that far. But yeah, I mean, that concept probably became bigger in the subsequent few years where it was just like, hey, whoever the best rebounder is in college basketball, draft that guy because there's a decent chance he's going to be pretty good. Because like Paul Millsap was that kind of rebounder in college.
Well, it's like your options are I could draft Peter Faja, who's probably not good at anything. You know, you could draft somebody who's average at every single thing there is, which means that in the NBA they'll be bad at every single thing there is. Or you could draft somebody who has one particular skill, and they will probably still be good at that in the NBA.
I mean, rebounding in particular, just because that was one that translated particularly well to the NBA. But, of course, you can draft Peter Faza and then get Reggie Evans as an undrafted free agent, and that's actually probably the way to play it.
Yeah, that's value right there. You get Peter Faza and Reggie Evans. okay, so this doesn't change my perspective about 2002.
We should talk about the Mariners, who had their last winning season for a while. They went 93-69, but faded a little bit, if I recall correctly, down the stretch.
This was the first year of the streak, though.
Correct. And wow. So my memory of the 2002 Mariners is our mom had entered, I think I was the one who technically won, a contest to attend their last road series of the season in Anaheim.
Wow.
And so I think we only went to one of the three games. We mostly just went to Disneyland, but went to the game on Saturday that they lost 8-4 to the Anaheim Angels, who I believe that was the year that Anaheim went on to win the World Series, right? Yeah, it was.
There was a World Series in Anaheim?
There sure was.
Okay.
It was Anaheim versus the Giants in that one.
Wow.
That was like the Rally Monkey era. You remember that?
Oh, man, that is... Anaheim versus the Giants is gone from my mind. if I knew it at any point, we used to watch, oh my god, what was Channel 1, right?
Yep.
We used to watch Channel 1 every morning, and I remember, I think it was this year, where I was like, I feel like we watched it even in high school, Channel 1. And it would be like 15 minutes of news as told by like 20-somethings.
Oh, but some of them went on to become big stars.
I know. I'm trying to think of who
was Anderson Cooper on Channel 1?
I think Anderson Cooper might have been on Channel 1.
I am very confident.
There were a couple of like pretty big names. Former anchors. Here we go.
Yeah, there's Anderson Cooper.
Serena Altschul. Remember her? Oh, my God.
Lisa Ling?
Oh, yeah. I definitely remember watching Lisa Ling on Channel 1.
Maria Menounos.
And I remember them talking about the World Series, and I was like, okay, that's who's playing in the World Series. Cool. Like, I was so uninformed about baseball that I learned about it from Channel 1 News, which is like, if you're learning about any news from Channel 1, like, you have to be the least informed person on Earth.
I don't have any thoughts about the 2002 Mariners other than that memory. But that also intersects with the 2002 Seahawks.
Really?
Because we were flying back from, it was probably John Wayne Airport, on the Sunday night.
You think you flew into Burbank?
John Wayne. That's not Burbank. John Wayne is in Orange County.
Oh, are you sure about that?
Yeah, it's Bob Hope Airport.
Bob Hope is Burbank, of course.
Yeah. And the Seattle Seahawks were playing on Sunday Night Football against the Minnesota Vikings after getting off to an 0-3 start. And I remember flying over what was then Seahawks Stadium, now CenturyLink, and not having any idea what was happening in the game.
Information is not available to you on an airplane in 2002, unless the pilot tells you the score.
Yes. Maybe the only source
of information you is the pilot via flight controller, whatever. Like, nobody was getting information otherwise. They don't have up-to-date newspapers on the plane in 2002.
So we mentioned on last week's pod Sean Alexander's penchant for big games in night games on national TV, and that game had 4 touchdowns, including an 80-yard pass from Trent, or 5 touchdowns, I should say. Ran for 4, caught an 80-yard pass from Trent Dilfer.
Trent Dilfer is still the quarterback.
Still the quarterback, as the Seahawks won that one 48-23.
Wow, they still had Matt Hass benched?
Matt Hass started most of that season, so I'm not sure what exactly was going on at that point.
That is,
I guess,
so strange.
Hass was definitely healthy, but I guess it was because they started 0-3. Maybe that's the answer.
It's like the part of the Matt Hasselbeck era, which I think we all look back on Matt Hasselbeck extremely fondly and is a very good quarterback.
Oh, for sure.
But the part of the Matt Hasselbeck era that we don't think about, which we talked about this last week, but like, he didn't play that much for these first 2 years. Even after they traded a second-round draft pick for him, I mean, he played, but, like, we weren't convinced that Matt Hasselbeck was going to become and I don't know if he ever became a star quarterback, but, like...
He did.
Matt Hasselbeck was going to become a Super Bowl-caliber quarterback.
So he did not take back over. He started week one, And then, then did not start the next six games, did not take back over as the starter until week eight. But by the end of that season, you started to see it. He threw for 362 yards against Kansas City in a 39-32 win, 427 yards against San Francisco in a 31-24 loss, and then 449 yards in a 31-28 win at San Diego in the season finale.
Also, this was the year Jeremy Stephens started playing for the Seahawks.
He sure did.
This was for that first era of Seahawks success. Also, Dallas Cowboys defensive coordinator Chris Richard. For the Seahawks, if you take that first era of success in the last two decades and compare it to this current success period, this was their 2008. Is that right? This wasn't the year that they made the playoffs and beat the Saints. This was the next, the Travaris Jackson year. That was 2008, right?
2011.
Oh, sorry, 2011.
This was
2011. It was like they weren't quite good enough to make the playoffs, but by the end of the season, you were like, this is a team, and they have the general outline of a team that can be an extremely successful team.
They won the last three games of the regular season, and Corin Robinson was coming into his own. We talked about him last week as a rookie. 78 catches for 1,240 yards this season and five touchdowns.
I love this offseason additions and subtractions. Brandon Mitchell and Jerry Wunsch, those were the additions?
I'm pretty sure that Jerry Wunsch was a cast member on Law & Order.
And then they lost Charlie Rogers, RIP, in the expansion draft.
Yeah.
And then the Texans actually just traded him for a seventh round pick.
So not the most memorable Seahawks season.
Things were starting to move, but if you were to ask me about any specific game from the season, I do not remember it. Wow, Jeff George is the backup quarterback.
Well, no, he would have been the third stringer.
After Jeff Kelly?
For the Seahawks?
Oh, well, did Dilfer get released?
No, I don't think so.
Maybe he finished the season on IR. That's why he's not on the Wikipedia page.
That would make sense.
Also, this running back depth, they just had Sean Alexander and then two fullbacks.
No, they had Marcus Morris. Or Maurice Morris, I should say.
Oh, and Mo Morris. Where is he? Yeah.
I don't know, but I see him on
the They did draft Mo Morris. We loved him, too. Even having gone to Oregon, we were like, we're all in on Mo Morris.
Liked him long before he dated one of my close friends.
Great.
2002 Huskies football team. Rough season. With maybe the best Seattle sports highlight of 2002 besides trading Vin Baker. Finished that season
Trading Vin Baker is the highlight.
It was a very exciting moment at that point, and we're being honest here. Finished that season 7-6, 4-4 in Pac-10 play, lost the Sun Bowl to Purdue.
Uh-huh.
But
so they played Purdue in back-to-back years?
No, the two out of three.
Okay.
That was 2000 was the Rose Bowl. Big fall for both teams from the Rose Bowl to the Sun Bowl. Okay, so that season starts
Both teams lost their starting quarterbacks.
Yeah, but the Huskies were actually pretty good in 2001. 2002 was a pretty big disappointment. They came into the season ranked 11th in the country, and they're playing at number 13 Michigan in a rematch of the previous year's matchup in Seattle, a game that the Huskies should have won but lost in large part because they were called for 12 men on the field on a Michigan punt, I believe.
It was a field goal.
Or maybe it was a field goal and they went on to score a touchdown. It was definitely a special teams play.
And they came back and hit the field goal. They missed it the first time.
Okay.
And then we had 12 men on the field and then they came back and hit it, and that's how they won the game.
I mean, that checks out.
And it was devastating at the time.
It was.
I mean, they turned out to not be that good of a team long-term through the season, but, like, this was also Peter Clay Carroll's first year at USC, right?
That sounds right.
And so they went into Carson Palmer's USC, and that was when I think things started really falling apart, was the big loss.
No, this wasn't his first season. This was his second season as head coach. This is the year they really started clicking, though. That was the year that they went to the Orange Bowl.
Okay, so what was the memorable moment from that year?
The memorable moment was the Apple Cup.
Jason Gesser's Washington State Cougars.
This is the 12-man penalty.
Talking Cougs, Jason
this
Gesser.
Is the 12-man penalty moved them into field goal range.
Okay.
They had not previously made a field goal. They had previously missed 3 field goal attempts in the game. Very reminiscent of Oregon 2 years ago, I think, right? Oregon couldn't make a field goal and then ended up making that game winner in overtime.
They hit the field goal to send it to overtime.
Oh, right.
And then we lost because they scored a touchdown in overtime.
You'd have missed the field goal.
Yeah, I remember that.
Yeah, that was not great. Okay. So this was the Northwest Championship season.
Oh, God.
The Huskies were 4-5. They were 2-4 in Pac-10 play. No, they had to have been worse than that. They had to have been 1-4 in Pac-10 play. Yeah, they had only beaten one team that was not San Jose State, Wyoming, or Idaho through week 10 of the season, or game number 10 at least. And then they run off back-to-back-to-back wins, home versus Oregon State, at Oregon. There was one other win in there, but there were going to be a lot of other wins at Oregon. And then the Apple Cup against number 3 Wazoo, which was still holding out outside hopes of getting into the BCS championship game, is an undefeated team, and win that one in double overtime, I think.
They weren't undefeated, were they? 26.
Oh, no,
record was 10-3, so they couldn't have lost twice after that.
They did have one loss coming into that one, but they were ranked number 3 in the country, so they had an outside chance of getting into the BCS.
So this was the 3 overtime game, really one of the most legendary games in the whole Apple Cup history.
Yeah. I thought you had Huskies more. Huskies hang on.
Huskies hang on. And Wazoo's. I mean, this might have been the best Wazoo team of the last 2 decades, right?
The last 2 decades would cut off the Ryan Leaf team. So,
and that's the only other option is that Leaf team that went to the Rose Bowl and played against Michigan. But like,
I mean, these are probably the two best. I don't know anything about like the ancient. They're certainly the two best Wazoo teams of our lifetimes.
And having the Huskies, the last time that Wazoo was a really good team, right? I mean, since then they've had some good seasons, but I don't think they've ever been this good. And having those hopes be dashed by the Huskies in Pullman is so poetic.
Right? I vividly remember that night because the Sonics were playing in Dallas. And so I was flipping back and forth between that Sonics game because I believe the Mavericks were still undefeated at that point of the season.
November 23rd?
Yeah, they had gotten off to an extremely good start that year.
I guess season started later then.
I also vividly remember like referencing that they were the only thing hotter than Halle Berry in the new Bond movie. That was
Die Another Day.
that win moved them to 13-0 in the season. They won one more game and then eventually lost their 15th.
This was Nash and Nowitzki?
Yep.
Or did they had Nash at the time?
They still did, yes. And they were playing a lot of zone defense.
Oh wow, modern.
Exactly.
but it was like this is the ultimate example of cooging it. This is what it is. Like this is having an opportunity to beat your biggest rival in your house to go to the Rose Bowl and fucking it up.
Well, they did still go to the Rose Bowl. They had to beat UCLA the next week. Now, if you're a Cougar fan, you would turn this around and say, having all the talent that UW did on their team and going 7-6 is a much greater example of cooging it.
I guess so. There's no cooging it, though. Cooging it is having an opportunity in your hand and then not being able to execute on it. And
okay, then the Michigan game.
UW probably has their own version of that, which is underachieving with talent, especially in the early 2000s.
Nate Robinson. Yeah, I forgot about Nate Robinson playing football that year. Ah.
Wow, Nate Robb at cornerback before Husky basketball was any good.
Yeah.
So it was 2003 when Husky basketball turned around.
So 2002 was the year that Bob Bender got fired.
The last of the Romar era. So Romar's first year was the year that they made the tournament and played against.
No, Romar Romar's first year, they were ninth in the Pac-10.
So it was Nate Robb's second year playing basketball that they got good, the Arizona game.
Yes.
Okay.
And his first year playing basketball full time, because in his freshman year, he only joined the team after the football season.
Can you imagine somebody with, man, Pete Carroll must have been disgusted when he saw Nate Robinson playing cornerback across the field from him. He was like, his arms are how long? No way. He's how tall?
Lorenzo Romar was like the Huskies, I don't know, probably like fourth or fifth choice, I think, in their coaching search that year after they fired Bob Bender. They really,
did this,
I think,
happen in 2002? Can we talk about this?
Yeah.
We can talk about this in earnest. Okay.
Yeah, we can talk about it right now. They really, I think, if I recall correctly, wanted to hire Dan Monson, who had been at Gonzaga previously and then had gone to Minnesota.
Minnesota.
Yeah.
So they won Monson. I mean, Bob Bender had the highest heights that Husky basketball had in a while. There's no history to the program at all. Really, there still wasn't. But like, it's not a prestigious program.
But yes.
Nobody's like, oh, the UW program. It's different than football, right? They haven't won two national championships.
No. Since they were good for large stretches of the Marv Harshman era, including the Detlef Schrempf, Christian Velp teams, including with Romar as a player. But then the coaches that succeeded Marv Harshman were awful until Bender, who was okay.
Yeah, and Bender had some good years. They showed that highlight now that SportsCenter is just showing classic. They showed the Rip Hamilton game, and I was like, fuck you, Scott Van Pelt. You know what? For this reason and only this reason, I wish they were still playing basketball. Bringing in Lorenzo Romar ushered in a new era for Husky basketball. And
for
like,
sure.
there was no better hire that they could have made. I mean, we talked about this when he was unfortunately fired. Lorenzo Romar is probably the second best basketball coach in UW history.
You're saying after Harshman?
Yeah, or maybe even ahead of Marv Harshman.
I would put him ahead myself.
And ahead of Marv Harshman. I mean, the names that came through in the Lorenzo Romar era are extremely impressive. And he really put UW basketball on the map in a way that it hadn't been. And I think the city of Seattle, which I think the 90 Sonics deserve a lot of credit for making Seattle a basketball town. But like, Lorenzo Romar capitalizing on that and continuing to make Seattle a basketball town after that. Like, the amount of talent that comes out of Seattle that's playing in the NBA currently is unheard of from what we grew up with.
Okay, these are not necessarily all people they actually went with, but would you like to read a list of candidates when Bob Bender got fired? Gonzaga coach Mark Few, Missouri's Quinn Snyder, Mercer Island native. Romar was the third person mentioned.
I mean, those first two are extremely good coaches.
Stan Heath.
Never heard of him.
Dana Altman.
Wow.
Ben Howland.
Oh, man.
And Dennis Felton, who was at Western Kentucky.
So a lot of those coaches actually turned out to be very good coaches.
They could have done just fine with a few of those. But obviously, I mean, we're very, very glad that they chose Lorenzo Romar. It worked out quite well.
Wow, Dana Altman.
Yeah.
Interesting. But also, we just love Lorenzo Romar, and always will.
Yeah. And especially after this UW season.
This is not Hopkins' fault.
Apparently Quinn Snyder did turn down the job.
He was at Missouri at the time and turned it down?
Yep.
I mean, I don't know if UW at that time was a better job than Missouri. I don't know if it's a better job now.
Was 2002, I think it was 2003, was the year of the first battle in Seattle that Missouri played, and that was a lot of fun.
But this was one of the few positives that came out of the year 2002, which leads me to 2002 in music.
Okay, wait, hold on. We have one more topic to discuss. And we haven't gotten to them yet because they weren't part of our lives. The Seattle Storm. I mean, I guess we discussed LJ a little bit last week. 2002 was the first year I started following the Storm because I had gotten connected through Dean Oliver, the godfather of basketball statistics.
Wow. More name dropping.
Yeah, going to be a lot of that. Not a lot. No, I don't know what more there's going to be. there was a project to track defensive stats for Dean at all the WNBA games, and I volunteered to do it at the Storm games and got a press credential because one of Dean's friends was worked in PR in the WNBA and still does, and is a friend of mine as well. I won't mention him because you would call that name dropping.
No one would know the name.
John Maxwell. There you go.
Wow, John. I had to do it. John Maxwell. We're all impressed.
So it was very exciting because this is the first time I'd ever had a media credential. It was before, you know, getting hired by the Sonics as an intern that fall. And, you know, I come in not really knowing much about the WNBA. Like, I'd heard of Sue Bird, obviously, who was the number one pick that year after UConn went undefeated. She led maybe the most talented women's basketball college team ever. Although I'm sure the Stewie-led teams would give you a run for that one as well, because Swin Cash was also on those teams. They had four players drafted, and I think the first six picks, and then the fifth starter was Diana Taurasi. So they were pretty damn good. And it took me precisely two games to like fall in love with Sue's game and the WNBA, and have been a big fan and supporter ever since. So the Storm that year started off kind of slowly, but caught fire in the second half of the season. And then, no pun intended, faced a kind of a must-win game, almost loser-out game, against the rival Portland Fire in the second-to-last game of the season. And Sue scored like 33, I think it was her career high at that point, to beat the Fire. The Storm beat Utah in their next game to secure a playoff spot. They then got quickly swept by the LA Sparks out of the playoffs. But that is a... that was a lot of fun to start watching the Storm. And then also one of my defining memories of 2002, I hadn't thought about this in a long time, that playoff game I went to, game one against the Sparks, I was still dealing with the after effects of us having our wisdom teeth out at the same time.
Oh my God. I just put the blanket over my face. It
hit you so much more than it did me for whatever reason.
You didn't have effects of it?
That was like, we had our teeth out probably on Monday.
Oh my God.
Monday or Tuesday. And that game was on Thursday, and I was able to go to it. And I feel like you were just like still on the couch at that point.
We went to Black Angus, and you ate at Black Angus or whatever.
That was my basically my first solid food since.
And then. I was like, oh, fuck, I guess I have to also.
Angus.
I was like, if Al's going to eat at Black Angus, I need to also. Man, 2002 was bad. Okay, so. Basically, okay, here's my take. 2002 was the worst year of my entire life.
Are you familiar with 2020?
Not personally. This is not personally. This is just objectively speaking. We can't judge a year while we're in it. It's not like I had a bad 2002
personally.
I feel
like we can judge this year. What's going to happen
looking
the rest
back,
of this year?
Look, well, at least we'll remember it. Right?
It's going to offset the global pandemic.
Blank. And then of that, I couldn't remember anything. And then you're like, oh, and you got your wisdom teeth taken out.
That was like really the most memorable thing that I thought about it. Oh, okay. I think there is no question that 2002 is the most forgettable year of our lifetime.
It's terrible. It is terrible.
Like I went through the film, the movies that were released in 2002, the music that was released
in
2002.
Music? Because 2002 in film is like, it's the shitty sequel that nobody wants.
I just
right?
kept like, scrolling down and it was like, what? I mean, there were some good movies probably that were released in 2000. There were some good movies that were released in 2002, but nothing that I would have paid attention
like
to at the
Scooby-Doo,
time.
Scooby-Doo the movie? What are the good movies that were released in 2002?
First off, did Scooby-Doo the movie come up previously?
No, I don't think so. This was the year that brought us Goldmember. Like, 2002 is a bad year. Even I will stand as much as anybody for the Star Wars prequels, but this even had the most objectively bad Star Wars prequel. This was the year that gave us Hayden Christensen's acting, right? Like, 2002 is a bad year.
I feel like the first Bourne movie is, like, something.
I guess so. I don't care about the first Bourne movie. Do you?
No, but other people do.
Sure. It's fine. I remember at the time being... I thought Gangs of New York was pretty cool. I learned who Daniel Day-Lewis was at the time. I remember distinctly going to see Chicago and being like, oh yeah, that movie was awesome. But it's just like, none of these, I'm just like, is The Bourne Identity a classic movie? 2002
adaptation
fucking sucks. 2002 is the worst year.
It was a bad year. You haven't mentioned 8 Mile, which was a very important film.
We haven't talked about 2002 in music yet.
Well, it's a movie. I don't know if you're aware of it.
All right, but it's not. It's not a movie. It gave us Barbershop, though. So there is that. Thanks, 2002. Also, All About the Benjamin, starring Mike Epps. I'm just like, this was the year that the worst of all the sequels came out of every film series.
Yeah, Men in Black 2.
It was all 2, right? It was number 2 of so many things. It was Lord of the Rings 2. It was Harry Potter 2. It was Star Wars 2.
Spider-Man.
It was that first Spider-Man, which is a big hit, but also it's
upside
not like,
down kiss, right?
Yeah, that was a meme before memes existed.
It really was.
Okay, so I was looking at 2002 in music, and I'm just like, I thought last week as like, 2002 is when it's all going to happen.
No.
It didn't happen.
Did not happen.
2002 is a terrible, there's one artist who released their best record in 2002. And I'll talk about them in a second. But like, this is just like artists releasing their most forgettable music happened in the year. And maybe this was a 9/11 hangover or something. I don't know how it all coalesced to being like, 2002 is going to be a shitty year for everything. And I personally think that this is the year that really was the catalyst for a whole generation of people becoming quote-unquote indie,
yeah,
because of how bad 2002 was in mainstream music. 2%. But I do have to say, an album that I still care so much about, and remember, this is the first real foray into being indie, right? I was like, I like The Strokes. That's still a major label release. And I'm not going to say that this isn't. It's a quasi-major label release, but like, and I bought it at Best Buy. But I think I got, like, not sick or whatever, but I remember it was a really long winter, and I had, like, a one CD changer next to my bed in a lawn chair. And I just remember it being a really long winter. And I got a CD that year, which actually came out in, maybe I actually got this in 2003, because of how far behind, because I think it came out in, it came out in August. I think I might have gotten it in 2003. But the record Turn on the Bright Lights by Interpol. And it's like, it is unparalleled in the amount that it changed my life.
Really? The Interpol record?
It was like, I remember turning it on and just being like, what the fuck is this? You know, it was like, and if you knew who the influences were, you would recognize them. But 17-year-old me had no idea who they were. But also, as far as encapsulating mood, or as like that early 2000s in New York sounds like Turn on the Bright Lights. Especially because I
would, you know,
never went there. But no, it was just like, this is to me, if I had to like, if you had to paint a picture of what it sounded like to be in New York City in the sort of like kind of like bleak time period post 9/11, it's like, that is Interpol, right? And it's this time period where there are all these cool young kids who are trying to establish themselves. I mean, there's a fucking book about this period in New York music, right?
Mm-hmm.
And
is there a name to that book?
The Strokes Matter. That book is called, wait, is it called Meet Me in the Bathroom? Yes. That book is called Meet Me in the Bathroom. Rebirth and Rock and Roll in New York City. But this is like 2001 to 2011. It was like, it started with Is This It? But really the first Interpol record was like, it changed my life completely. Like, I had no idea what indie music was at the time, but this was music that wasn't aggressive. It was all about mood. And it wasn't like, it wasn't about hooks. It wasn't about fucking guitar solos. It was just like, this makes you feel like you're in a certain place. And I don't think that any of the important indie records that came after it, which none of them came out in 2002 because it was a terrible fucking year, could have happened without this album. It also came out on an actual indie label in Matador Records. And I was so indie at the time that I remember going and buying it at Best Buy.
Can we talk about 8 Mile now?
Okay, but just one more second on this. Right. But like, to this day, I will still turn it on. I'm just like, I fucking stand for Turn on the Bright Lights by Interpol. But it was like, I would get the inserts, the Best Buy ad in the newspaper every Sunday and look through. They would have CDs for like $6.99 or $7.99 or whatever. I mean, there was tons that I got during that period for about that price. And it was like, the Paranoid by Black Sabbath. I was like, what's this? I was like, maybe I should just buy that at $6 or whatever. You know? And then somehow they got the distribution, Matador had the distribution, to be in the Best Buy ad. And again, I think I got it in like January of 2003. So I'm giving this credit to 2002, which it doesn't deserve. But like, I remember listening to it that winter. I was playing Madden a ton.
Yep.
Madden 04, probably, I guess, 03. I think Mike Vick was on the cover. And just, I was playing Madden a ton, being depressed, and listening to Interpol. And I was like, this is my life. 6 months. And it was great.
Marshall Faulk
and
was on the cover
loved
of Madden 03.
Oh, I remember that, yeah. I remember Marshall Faulk in that Rams jersey.
It was Madden 04 that Vick was on.
Then, later that year, the only artist to release their best music, not their best album, but their best music in 2002. We all got together. I think this was you, me, Katie, and Chris. And we went to the fucking Lewis and Clark, right?
I don't specifically remember this.
You don't remember this?
No.
I think it was over Christmas break. We went to, I'm pretty sure it was Lewis and Clark. Maybe it was Parkway Plaza. And we went to go see 8 Mile. And we came home. And all we wanted to do was rap battle.
I do think there was some attempt at a rap battle. Oh, dear.
It was all you could do after seeing that movie.
Yeah.
I mean,
so
Eminem.
You're going with Lose Yourself is the best Eminem?
Well, I actually think Till I Collapse is the best Eminem song.
Till I Collapse is the one that they used to play at Husky Games, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
But from an outside, Till I Collapse is an excellent song. From an outside perspective, though, of like just what it meant, Eminem had reached his peak with Lose Yourself, right? Like he will never, ever be better than that. When he took the whole premise of the movie and then the verse where he's like, fuck that, this didn't exist or whatever, there's no Mekhi Phifer.
There's no Mekhi Phifer. That line gets me every time.
And you're just like,
you're in
the moment. And then you're just like, holy shit.
You're saying
Eminem just,
you lose yourself?
He ruled. He was like, this movie doesn't exist. Here's where we are. This is my real life. Right? And you're like, he is on another level as far as what he's talking about. Right?
Yeah. Okay, so there are two 2002 albums that I have listened to within the past 2 weeks. Do you care to guess what those two albums are?
Wow, I have no idea. I don't think I could. I looked through them, but... Oh, I had one more album that I wanted to bring up.
What?
Also, and it might be one of the two. Is it The Rising?
The Rising is one of those, yes.
Yes.
Because we talked about 9/11. I had to go listen to The Rising.
Uh-huh. And what is the other one?
The other one is Phrenology.
Oh, wow.
I've been listening to a lot of music, so I've been going all over the board lately. But that is, for some reason, that's a random album that I ended up with the CD of at some point, and love that album, and in particular, The Seed. 2.0, The Seed 2.0.
Oh, that's the best song.
Yeah.
With Cody Chestnut. And yeah. And also, the first Cody Chestnut album came out in 2002.
So, yeah.
Hold on. I wanted to do a little bit of comparison between two lyrics, because I was listening to Till I Collapse. So I remember, I was done with rap music by 2002, basically, like mainstream rap music. I was like, I'm not interested in this at all as a genre. But I remember I had a burnt CD, probably from Chris, maybe from Mitchell Dillard, of the Eminem Show, I think it was called.
Yes.
And I listened to it and I was like, this is all fine. Everything in here is just fine. And then I hear that and it's like that. And you're just like, oh, fuck. And then it hits you so hard. Right. And it was like, I heard it and I was like, oh, this is the best Eminem song. And it's kind of crazy how things catch up over time, where now if you go to Spotify, like, this is the number one song. If you would have told me in 2002 that this was going to be the number one Eminem song on Spotify, I would have never believed you, because I was like, there's huge songs, right?
Yeah.
Like, the songs from the previous records, where I was like, My Name Is, like, no song will ever top that, you know?
The Real Slim Shady. But those, I feel like, because of the fact that they were more, I don't want to say gimmicky, but they're sort of in that realm. Whereas Till I Collapse is more, like, timeless.
Yes.
I am surprised that Stan is not on this top 10 at all. I mean, obviously, a lot of it is taken up by his newest release. But
I wanted to compare the Eminem talking about on that track, because he's like, when your run is over, just admit it when it's at its end. And it's like, I don't compare that to Rosa Parks, where Andre's rapping about like how his favorite rappers aren't good anymore. I thought he had a line about, he hope it never comes to him or whatever.
By the way, is The Blueprint 2, The Gift and the Curse, does that fall under the sequels in 2002?
Oh my god. The sequels of 2002 were very, very bleak. Okay, so the other record that you listened to, in The Rising, and look, this is not Bruce Springsteen's best music ever, but for us, as a gateway to Bruce Springsteen's music, this was the most important record.
We were excited, like, we had gone back to Bruce Springsteen's catalog, I'm sure, by this point, but we were excited to have a Springsteen album that we could experience with everyone else. Does that make sense?
Kind of. I don't know how many other people were experiencing The Rising at Tai High School in 2002. By everyone else, do you mean you? And for you, you mean me? Like, there's nobody
the
else
in the world
who is listening to the Rolling Stone magazine. Like,
yes, there we go.
They were very stoked about it. But this to me was like, I think I probably got Born to Run.
It was Springsteen's first number one album on the U.S. pop albums.
God. I got Born to Run, I think, probably from Best Buy for $6.99 or whatever. And I was like, oh, this is really cool and I like it. And then The Rising came out and it was like Christmas Day I got it. I got it for Christmas. Do you remember this?
Not specifically.
And I put it in the CD player or whatever.
Not in July. You waited that long?
That's how long it took to hear new music in 2002. It really didn't. Like, the fucking Rolling Stone only came out every 2 weeks. I heard fucking Paranoid by Black Sabbath 50 years later in 2002.
Well, true. But the only way you'd find out is if the pilot came over the intercom.
Oh, we've got the Rising by Bruce Springsteen on your left ear. No, it was just like, I got it for Christmas because you didn't get music immediately in 2002. That's not the way it worked. The Rising wasn't played on the radio. I think I started to get Rolling Stone magazine. I remember the first ever Rolling Stone I read, there was a review of Yoshinoyi Battles the Pink Robots by Flaming Lips, which is maybe the only band who's released their best album in 2002 aside from Interpol. And like, I remember reading that review and it was like sort of lukewarm, because that's what Rolling Stone would do, because it's fucking Rolling Stone and they're not going to be impressed by Flaming Lips in 2002 until they get popular. And it was like, I was like, oh, this seems like kind of interesting music. And then I could never hear it or whatever until it was in a Microsoft commercial 3 years later. It's not like I had means to go and listen to the Flaming Lips.
Have you just been sitting here on this pilot voice the entire time? Oh, I can't wait to bring that back at some point.
Okay, so I also think 2002 was the year that killed mainstream rap music for me. I've felt this way beyond Let's Remember Some Years. The thing that I hate the most in all of music for my entire life, and I hate a lot of things about mainstream music in my entire life, is Ja Rule and Ashanti. And it's just like, Ja Rule thinks that he fucking cracked the code, right? Whereas, like, it's so shameless, right? Where it's like, Ja Rule's going to rap his little bullshit rap, and then there's going to be, like, the pop hook. And this is the worst music that ever existed. I swear to God, indie rap became a thing. I think God Loves Ugly by Atmosphere came out in 2002 also. But, like, indie rap became a thing because of how fucking bad Ja Rule is. Also, Quality, which we haven't talked about Dave Chappelle, we will in a couple of years, but Quality by Talib Kweli came out in 2002 also, which has the Dave Chappelle intro. Let me read you the Billboard year-end Hot 100 singles of 2002 through number 12, because that's when we get to fucking Ja Rule and Ashanti. Let me just ask you if any of these you would objectively call a good song.
I think I have one objection, at least.
Number one. How You Remind Me by Nickelback. Is that your objection?
No.
Foolish by Ashanti. Hot and Her by Nelly.
That's my exception.
Okay. No, it's fine. Like,
remember the radio station that played Hot and... Was that Hot and Here?
Hot and what Her? Radio station?
There was the radio station that played a Nelly song on repeat as part of like the promotion for their changeover to R&B or hip-hop. And...
Because of how bad 2002 was.
Then no, this was like within the last 5 years. And then everyone went and listened to it. It must not have been that.
Dilemma by Nelly featuring Kelly Rowland.
Okay.
Wherever You Will Go by The Calling. 1,000 Miles by Vanessa Carlton. In the End by Linkin Park. What's Love by Fat Joe featuring Ashanti. You Got It Bad by Usher. Blurry by Puddle of Mud. Blurry by Puddle of Mud. Was number 10. Are you hearing this?
I'm hearing it.
Complicated by Avril Lavigne. And at number 12, Always on Time by Ja Rule featuring Ashanti.
That was 6 years ago at that San Francisco radio station KVVF repeated.
I hope they folded. Like, there is not a good song in the top 20 of the Billboard Hot 100 songs of 2002. Like, the best case scenario, you've gotten to, like, all right, I can stomach that, right? Like, we haven't looked at this for every year, so maybe it's always terrible. But, like, none of these artists release their best song, even if you like the artist.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
Must be the money. 2002.
You Got It Bad. It's a good song. Although that actually came out in 2001. So there you go. There you go.
And a lot of these songs came out in 2001. 2002, it goes all the way through to My Sacrifice by Creed at number 20.
Okay.
But, like, it's bad. It is bad.
I agree. I mean, it'll be interesting to see if we have any objections, because I feel like if you were like, no, I don't know, maybe it'll be interesting to see if anyone objects.
To 2002 being a good year?
Yeah.
Cameron put out a pretty good album. But, like, I just... Oh, wait. I looked up 2002 in television. Let's see what we got. Survivor? Was it the first year of Survivor? No, that must have been earlier.
I didn't really notice anything notable in terms of coming or going in 2002 in television.
Because it was a fucking horrible year.
It was not a great year.
It was the first year of American Idol, so.
Definitely better than 2020.
And the first year of The Bachelor. Well, this was the year that brought us Monk.
Shouts to Monk.
Let's see what our good friends at hiphopgoldenage.com have to say about the year 2002.
I'm guessing there's going to be a lot of Talib Kweli.
Kweli.
I mean, not a lot of it, because they're doing albums now, right?
Yes. There actually are some good albums that came out in 2002. But this was the year Jay Live at number one, who I've also never heard of. All of the Above by Jay Live. Number two, Mr. Lift's I, Phantom, a Def Jux release. Number three, The Lost Tapes by Nas. So that would be like a Nas B-sides record. Number four, we had The Eminem Show, as previously mentioned. Number five, Scarface is The Fix. There's a couple more. Oh, Jurassic 5's Power Numbers, which is a good album. This is probably the first year that I learned who Jurassic 5 was, because of 120 Minutes was happening in 2002. So that's something. Blazing Arrow by Blacklicious was really good. The God's Son came out. It's just like, and then and number nine was Quality by Talib Kweli. Even still, it's not like I'm not blown away by these, right?
Yeah.
2002 fucking sucks. And Phrenology was at number 10.
I don't feel like I knew Jurassic... maybe in 2002.
God Bless That Blaze is number 13. This was definitely, like, indie rap was starting to become a big thing by 2002 because of how bad Ja Rule and Ashanti are.
Where is Ja?
I swear to God, it was just like, I remember hearing that song for the first time, and I was like, all right, I'm done with the radio. I'm good.
Yeah, never turn on the radio again.
I was like, I will talk about this later. There was a year where I came back to mainstream rap music in 2008 or so.
I mean, I think you came out back for the Black Album, but okay.
I really didn't. I mean, I don't know. We'll talk about the Black.
I actually came back for the Gray Album, but again, we're going to talk about that.
We'll talk about the Black and the Gray Album later, but like, What You Know by T.I., I was like, I remember we were watching that BET Awards at Katie's Now Your House, and I was like, hearing What You Know about that, I was like, oh shit. I was like, wow.
That's what it took.
I was like, damn, rap music's good again.
All right, follow tip. Should we talk about contemporary sports?
Nah.
To the extent that there are. There's some updates aside from the Seahawks. The NHL Seattle group, in a letter to fans from CEO Todd Lewicki, he said, we will wait to begin general seat selection, and we look for the right time to reveal our team name, which you'll recall was originally reported to be announced in March, and brand. We recognize the amount of excitement around this, and we appreciate your patience. The MLS officially postponed their games through mid-May. Not that that was any surprise after the original. I think they were...
That mid-May timeline means anything.
Right.
They've postponed their games until they can play games.
Everything is TBD. UW Spring Sports, all activities were officially canceled.
These notes are hilarious, where it's just like all these sports, there's nothing.
There really isn't. But there is.
UW Spring Sports, though, really quick.
Yeah.
The chatter is that athletes who play in spring sports will be able to come back for another year of eligibility next year.
Yes, the NCAA has indicated that that's what they expect to do.
Provided there is a next year. So,
I mean, just basically that it won't count as a year of eligibility for anyone. And it didn't even sound like just for seniors. It's even like, you know, if you're a freshman, you're still a freshman next year.
Interesting. So everybody's just coming back the same as they were.
Well, I mean, that'll be up to the individual. But
so this game, this year, doesn't exist like Super Bowl 49.
Like the end of Super Bowl 49, yes.
The curse catch exists.
I mean, so those games had all been canceled.
For his Hall of Fame case.
What got canceled last week specifically was spring practice for the football team.
Interesting.
So that... notable tie for the... You know, Jimmy Lincoln talked about wanting to have the highest attended spring game, and they are in a 12-way tie for... In the Pac-12?
They wouldn't have the highest attended in the conference.
Yes, not in the country, obviously.
Or of all time for UW.
In the conference.
Because he actually has now had the lowest attended spring game ever.
Well, you know.
Ugh.
So let's talk about the Seahawks and NFL free agency, which had begun last week when we podcasted, but now is really in full swing for the Seahawks, who have reportedly signed, some of these have been announced now, 7 players.
Offensive linemen.
Only 4 of them are offensive linemen. We talked about Jaron Reed last week, but yeah, they've been busy on the offensive line. They signed tackle Brandon Schell to a reported 2-year $11 million contract, which makes him the presumed replacement for Jermaine Ifedi, who remains unsigned. They signed interior lineman B.J. Finney to a 2-year contract worth up to $9.5 million with $4.5 million guaranteed. And then a couple of reclamation projects in Cedric Ogboihe and Chance Warmack, both of whom were first-round picks but have not lived up to those expectations.
The Ogboihe contract, I think I saw Barnwell be like, I don't grade.
Backup offensive lineman.
Backup offensive lineman deals, but this was the worst signing I've seen. The Seahawks make.
Yeah, he said since Jokel, and it's like Jokel wasn't even that long ago. Like,
I know. I don't think Jokel was that bad of a signing. Like, we don't look back on that as like, look, there have been so many.
It wasn't great.
I feel like not re-signing Sheldon Richardson is the one that really chaps me, but like, I don't know. Like, it was whatever signing Jokel. Who cares?
It's more just that they gave him so much money, despite the fact that there was no market for him, and there was so little market. Has he even played pro football since then?
Luke Jokel?
Yeah.
I don't think so.
Yeah. They paid him, like, multiple millions of dollars.
I thought it was, like, $5 million. 1 year, $5 million.
He has not played football since in the last two seasons. How much was the Luke Jokel contract? It was... yeah, there was a $4.25 million signing bonus, $2.75 million base, $250,000 roster bonus, for a total of $7.25 million.
Oh, my God.
that was a pretty damn bad contract.
This one is probably not that bad, but, like, it's a strange approach that we chatted this year about what the Seahawks need to do this offseason in free agency, etc. And, you know, they needed to address some things in the offensive line, but it didn't feel like volume was necessarily one of those things they needed to address.
Right.
And depth. And that seems to be the only thing they've cared about.
There's going to be a lot of competition in training camp, it seems like. And Ogboyehi, it's been reported by my ESPN colleague Jordan Schultz, is a maximum of $3.3 million, but we don't know in terms of guarantees how much of that is bonuses and how much of that is base, which will determine part of it. Let's go through these, starting with Brandon Schell, a fifth-round pick in 2016 out of South Carolina, who started all 26 games he played in 2017 and 2018 and 11 of the 15 he played last season. The good news, those for the Jets, by the way, the good news, just 11 penalties in 2,558 career snaps, according to Pro Football Reference. By comparison, Jermaine Ifedi topped that in both 2017 and 2019, with 13 penalties in 1,107 snaps last season. Now for the bad news, per stats perform is cited by Barnwell in his grade, gave up 7 sacks last season and 7.5 in 2017. If Fetty's career high in sacks allowed is 6.5. Barnwell in that review called him an average to below average right tackle, but graded the signee as a C in terms of value.
Great. Okay, so basically, we'll talk about this later when we talk about Clowney, but like, it's still... It represents a fundamental misvaluing of what's important.
Yeah. I mean, it may just be a reaction to the market.
This is cheaper, too. Like, Ifedi is probably going to get paid more than this.
It's kind of strange that he's still out there. You would think that he would certainly get more than George Fant, who got, you know, $10 million in terms of paper value per year. I didn't see what the breakdown in terms of guarantees ever was in that contract he got from the Jets. Finney, who was the first of these players to sign.
One more thought on that.
Oh, yeah.
I don't care about penalties that much.
I care about penalties a lot.
What I care about is being a good offensive lineman play after play. And we don't necessarily – look, how much do we know about a Jets offensive lineman? Basically nothing. But, like, it is more important to be a skilled offensive lineman than it is to not commit penalties. Commit penalties if you're good. Whatever.
Well, I don't know that Jermaine Ifedi was that good, but I disagree because penalties put you in such a huge hole. Like, I'd rather
sacks put you in a worse hole.
No, they don't. Not if you have called draws on 1st and 20. I mean, obviously, I don't want Russell Wilson to get injured, and so from that standpoint, a sack is better than a hold. But also, Russell Wilson's very good at scrambling. So,
what is the average loss on a sack? You lose both a down plus the yardage. Are you kidding me?
Yeah, downs aren't that valuable when you run.
Well, what do you think the Seahawks average per down?
I mean, they average about 5 yards per play.
And what is the average sack? 5 yards? Maybe a little bit less? I don't know how you could possibly say this.
But it's just... it gets you so far. It was interesting because there was an argument by my
sack is colleague. So much more devastating than a hold.
Not for the Seahawks. I get that in the grand scheme of things, but you have a team that is going to run a fucking 2-yard draw on 1st and 20 every time.
Kill me.
There was an argument by my ESPN colleague Brian Burke last year that penalties needed to be made harsher in terms of yards because of the fact that teams average, you know, offenses has gotten so much better over time. And I was like, this does not check out as a Seahawks fan because it feels like any time there's a holding penalty, the drive is over immediately.
Okay, so BJ Finney.
I don't know if I was going to try and look up this average value of a sack, but they may take too long. BJ Finney signed with the Steelers as an undrafted free agent in 2014 and played both center and guard in Pittsburgh, made 13 starts over 4 seasons as a backup lineman, including 4 last season, 2 of those coming at center after Marquise Pouncey's suspension for his role in the altercation against Cleveland. Entered the NFL at age 23 and spent his first season on IR, so he will turn 29 during the 2020 season. Not exactly young. To me, the big question here is BJ Finney going to end up starting at left guard, or is he going to end up starting at center?
Instead
of seeing as a starter at all.
Justin Britt?
I think that if you look at the way the cap is setting up right now, if the Seahawks re-sign Jadeveon Clowney, I don't think it's reasonable for Britt to still be here on his current contract.
Okay.
Perhaps there's a restructuring. But also, like, if you sign 4 offensive linemen, it seems to be an indication that some of the offensive linemen currently on the roster are not going to stay there.
It's kind of strange.
Ogboehi was the number 21 pick in 2015 by the Bengals and started 25 games in 2016 when he mostly played right tackle, in 2017 when he slid to left tackle in place of Andrew Whitworth before losing his starting job in 2018. He signed a 1-year deal with the Jaguars last year for the veteran minimum and saw just 155 snaps last season as a reserve. So it is perplexing why you would need to offer him more than the minimum, I gotta say.
That's crazy. He was a first-round pick. Have you ever heard of this person?
Yeah.
Okay.
What with that name?
Great. Warmack, I know Chance Warmack. He went to Alabama, right?
Yeah, he was an even higher pick. He was the 10th overall pick by the Titans. Started all 46 games.
And they decided to draft a guard with the 10th overall pick.
He was the second guard taken in the top 10 that year. Started all 46 games he played in Tennessee, but had his 5th-year option declined, missed most of his final season due to a hand injury, then played 2 seasons as a reserve for the Eagles before he was out of the league entirely in 2019. It is somewhat disputed to what extent injury was a factor in that rather than just the league not being interested.
Great.
But it seems unlikely that there's going to be a $3.3 million potential investment in Warmack, so that seems like a better shot to take, even though he doesn't offer much positional versatility as strictly a guard. Also notably, the Seahawks brought back a couple of old friends, starting, you mentioned at the top, Bruce Irvin, back 5 years
Hello.
After he left for Oakland. Bruce! A lot of Bruces in today's pod. Spent last season with Carolina starting 12 of 13 games, recording a career-high 8.5 sacks.
There you go. More than against the Seahawks, right?
I don't remember specifically. That is more than twice as many as any Seahawks player recorded last season.
Wow.
Still no contract details for what Irvin got.
Up for the rising, Bruce.
Yes. It seems like he's going to profile as your number 2 pass rusher. Hopefully Jadeveon Clowney is the number 1.
Oh, God. We don't know what the money is, but, like, Bruce Irvin is still a pretty good pass rusher. You know, he's not at any sort of elite tier necessarily, but, like, Bruce Irvin...
When you start where the Seahawks were last year?
If you gave me the option of having Quentin Jefferson or Bruce Irvin as a pass rusher, I'm taking Bruce every time.
Yeah. And Quentin Jefferson got a lot of money from the Bills.
So I think this was a great move. And we've been predicting that Bruce was coming back so many times, right?
I mean, as you've mentioned on this podcast, the Seahawks love to bring back their former players.
I've mentioned everybody knows this. This is what they love to do.
And it is true.
Like, we sort of expected, since it didn't happen last year, it felt like last year was the time that it would happen. But when he was released by the Raiders, it was like, okay, Bruce is coming back. And then when he was being signed last year, it was like, okay, Bruce is finally coming back. And then he signs to the Panthers, and you're like, well, what? And then finally the Seahawks make it happen.
Yeah.
And bring Bruce home where he belongs.
I think they'd probably tried at some point in the previous, you know, in those times to do it, and it just hadn't worked out.
Let's just get the whole draft class back together.
No, I guess Kristen Michael wasn't part of that class. Who else was part of
that
class?
It was Turbin.
Oh, yeah.
Was it Bruce Irvin? Bruce Irvin was drafted ahead of Russell Wilson.
Yeah, he was the first round pick that year.
with Turbin and then Bobby Wagner and then Russ. Let's get the whole gang back together.
It's like Chris Durham might have been in there.
Chris Durham? No.
You don't think so?
No. This is 2013? Okay. 2012.
All right, the Seahawks actually were shockingly good last year in first and 20 situations because they had the Rashad Penny 58-yard touchdown run and a 44-yard pass from Russell Wilson to Tyler Lockett.
Why do you like to be wrong?
They only had three plays of three or fewer, and they averaged 6.6 yards per sack. I'm just saying that's how it feels.
Who's Chris Durham?
The wide receiver who didn't make the team out of training
camp. Oh, that's not his name. Chris Harper?
No, there was a that Chris Harper is also true of him. He was drafted in 2011, not in 2013. He was a fourth round pick. He actually did make the roster. Come to think of it, he played one season.
Look at this though. We've got the first three picks from 2012 are back though. How many teams could say that?
Probably not that many. Yeah,
is that their first three picks? And Sweezy's come and gone also.
Yeah, it's not too bad. Not too bad. Wait, first four picks, right? Because as you mentioned, Turbin is technically.
Oh, I guess he is technically a Seahawk. There we go.
Technically a Seahawk.
Bring Jay Howard back.
Jeremy Lane.
Oh my God.
I don't know what Corey Toomer is up to these days. Defensive back Winston guy. Greg Scruggs? He's still kicking around out there? I liked Greg Scruggs.
So
he's not played in the NFL since 2016.
Beyond that, there's been a lot of chatter about Clowney, right? Quite a bit of chatter linking him back to the Seahawks.
That seems to be the default assumption in the league.
And this is, I mean, like I was saying, about judging sacks versus really just general ability versus penalties. Like, it's a whole league misvaluing what Jadeveon Clowney can bring to the table. And the idea that his best offer could be, I mean, the initial chatter was like in the $15 million range. And now there was a rumor that his best offers were in the $13 million range, but the Seahawks might need to beat that. It's like, this is insane to me. That somebody whose pass rush win percentage is an elite level, one of the best pass rushers in the entire NFL. And yep. Maybe he doesn't have the sacks to go with it, but who the fuck cares about sacks in one season, right? Like, Jadeveon Clowney is a game-disrupting pass rusher.
And playmaker, just general playmaker.
Yeah, I mean, general playmaker on defense.
But look, this is what NFL teams do, and
he's
it's nice
a $20 million player.
Yeah, it would be nice if the Seahawks are not the ones making the terrible decision and are the ones benefiting from everyone else misvaluing things.
I guess so, but look, let's just make sure we do it.
I agree. I mean,
if you have to pay him $15 million or whatever, just do that. But like, sure, maybe you don't want to pay Clowney $22 million or something. Which I think we all agree he's worth in the $20 million range based upon that pass rush win rate.
And over multiple years, whereas it looks like he's probably looking for now a 1 or 2 year deal that would get him back out on the market with a chance to reprove his value.
Let's sign a 2 year deal. Let's just make sure it's not one because the money might be massive again next year. But like the idea that you're just judging sacks. And look, I think the real only thing that we can take from this is that the injuries are very serious.
At least a legitimate concern and something that's difficult for teams to assuage that concern because of the fact that, you know, in the midst of the novel coronavirus outbreak, it's difficult. Players can't be coming for meetings and to get physicals and that sort of thing.
So, and maybe that's part of it, where it's like they have some concerns about the injury. They can't be – look, the difference between seeing a player up close and having a conversation from far, I don't think is that great. But, like, whatever. If teams aren't willing to commit that kind of money, hopefully the Seahawks do, because it is a steal to get Clowney for $15 million or less.
They've already gotten one steal with Clowney in terms of the trade package. So, yeah, if they could get another in terms of this new contract, that would be awesome. I mean, I think one interesting thing is the fact that if it's a short-term deal, like oftentimes with these free agent long-term contracts, you're going to see them pretty heavily, you know, a lot of the value up front will be in the signing bonus, smaller salaries up front to manage the cap hit. If it is particularly a one-year deal, it's harder for the Seahawks to do that, which will be interesting what kind of other impact that would have.
Sure. But I mean, you feel a lot better with the pass rush. Let's say that the pass rush next year, I personally think Jordan Reed is going to be better next year than he was this year. It would be almost impossible not to be. And most likely will not be suspended. If you have Clowney plus Bruce Irvin plus Jordan Reed back, plus, I mean, there's still
Rasheem Green.
A chance of bringing in somebody like Everson Griffin, too. I don't think that's
unheard of. I think that would only be as a backup plan if Clowney left.
You think it would only be one or the other?
I think he's probably looking at, you know, whatever teams also are interested in, you know, don't get Clowney is a destination.
These are steals.
I mean, it's not going to be a situation where you sign both Michael Bennett and Cliff Averill.
Couldn't it be?
I don't think so. I used to get realistically with the cap. I don't think it's possible.
I'm just saying that there's an opportunity here to get Clowney on a very good deal, and the Seahawks need to make it happen.
Agreed. Yeah. I mean, there's no question about it. So the other old friend who did come back is Luke Wilson.
Hello.
Who announced his return shortly after we wrapped our last podcast. Seems likely insurance at a position where Greg Olsen has injury history and Will Dissly is coming off major surgery. The Seahawks also have Jacob Hollister at tight end.
A lot of
and technically Ed Dixon for the moment, but he will surely be released for cap purposes. Quentin Jefferson mentioned going to Buffalo, got $13.5 million over two seasons per Ian Rappaport of NFL Network. Good for you, Jeff, who made $2 million last season.
It's great. I mean, it sucks to lose QJF, but like, he'll be replaced by better options.
I've long thought him an underrated player, and he does not appear to be underrated anymore. So there you go.
He'll probably do great in that Bills defense.
Yeah, it should be a very good defense.
It does feel like, I mean, we talked about this last week with DeAndre Hopkins coming to the Cardinals. It still feels like, I don't know, the NFC West is not tooled up that much necessarily, you know, like I don't think I look at the 49ers and say to myself, like, this is a fundamentally better team than they were last year. I think they've maintained in a lot of ways and they have a very good draft pick that we'll see what they make of it. But like, still losing Emmanuel Sanders, I think, is an important thing. The Rams, Todd Gurley doesn't matter, but like, the Rams are probably going to be less talented next year than they were this year and going forward. But in general,
the Todd Gurley cap hit still matters.
I just feel like the NFC constantly is getting better.
It does seem like the players who have changed conferences, the best players who have changed conferences, have all gone AFC. Well, not all. I guess Stephon Diggs would have gone the other way. But DeAndre Hopkins, obviously, as we talked about last week, coming into the NFC West. And then we'll see what kind of upgrade, if any, Tom Brady is at quarterback for the Buccaneers.
TB12, but there's like Darius Slay going to the Eagles, where he's not going AFC to NFC, but he is going from a non-contender to a potential contender. It just seems like the NFC teams in general are continually getting better in ways. Where did Emmanuel Sanders sign with the Saints?
Yes.
Which is terrifying, right?
Yes, it is.
I don't see a lot of NFC teams getting notably worse.
But it never really looks that way in the offseason.
I don't know. The NFC is a much better league than the AFC as it is right now. And it seems like that's going to continue to be the case.
Yeah.
I mean,
but you're not as down as when we podcasted last week.
I don't know. I mean, look at the schedule. Look who the Seahawks have to play as far as they go at Atlanta, who, again, starting 10 of their 11 starters on offense were first-round picks, adding Hunter Henry, replacing Austin Hooper with Hunter Henry. They play at Buffalo, who just added Stephon Diggs. You have the Eagles adding Darius Slay. It's like none of these teams got worse. You know what I mean? Like, did the Cowboys get worse? I guess they do play the Patriots at Centurion Field. There's a team who got worse.
I had forgotten about that particular game.
And then they also play, which we'll see. They play the Vikings too, without Diggs. So I don't know, but really the schedule doesn't look that brutal necessarily.
It'll be interesting.
And there's about a million wildcard teams, so
that is helpful.
I think that the Seahawks still have a pretty good chance of making the playoffs. I don't know. I don't feel like they've become markedly better. And re-signing Clowney would make me feel a lot better, because I assume that his next season will be even better than this season.
Agreed. All right. On that optimistic note, we certainly hope for the best over the next week for the Seattle region and the country and world as a whole as we continue to battle the coronavirus outbreak. And thank you so much for listening.
Thanks.